think the system's
working.
No.
All right. I'll just speak, and if you can't hear, just go, and I'll speak louder. All right. So I don't get out to Fairfax enough, and it's a wonderful community that is very different from us in Arlington, who are very public policy, day-to-day focused. And so today, I decided rather than giving a standard talk of mine, I would do something that draws on the diversity of the Fairfax campus, which is that that the technology, the science, the history, the performing arts, and the culture is all here in Fairfax. And you'll say, what does that have to do with dark commerce? But you'll see, that's the coming attractions. Now, first of all, for this book, I owe an enormous thanks to the university and to President Cabrera. A few years ago, I had this idea for what I would call the third book in my trilogy, all of which I've written since I fortunately came to American University 11 years ago. So the first one was called Human Trafficking. The second one was called Dirty Entanglements, Corruption, Crime, and Terrorism. And when I was finished with Dirty Entanglements, I was finding how much illicit commerce was part of that story. And it just seemed to deserve another book. And it was in my head. And all of a sudden, I get asked by President Cabrera if I wanted to apply for a new fellowship that had just crossed his desk called the Andrew Carnegie Fellow Program to write on burning global issues. So I was very honored, and I took out what I did and started to work on this application. But this application was sort of overthink on what burning global problems were. I mean, it was country-based, it was WMD issues, it was issues of how the UN is functioning in a complex world. It was not exactly what my book was about. All of those pieces were part of my book. So I wrote them what my book would be about, and then showed how my book fitted into their conception of what critical problems were. And to my great surprise, I was one of the first winners. And the university was so happy, it gave me an extra year. And with that, I could basically write and finish this book. Unfortunately, the book took a little bit longer. I thought books always take longer. But I had to learn so damn much for this book. So when I got into this problem, I discovered that my historical understanding of this topic, especially outside the Western world, was deficient and not even that good in some parts of the Western world. I certainly didn't know enough about technology, and I didn't know enough about environment and conservation studies. And there were many colleagues here in Fairfax that helped point me in the direction. So let me say a little bit more about what I had to learn to do a book of this complexity. So I told you that I've written on human trafficking. But human trafficking doesn't exist in a vacuum. We've had slavery for a very long time. And this morning, I spent my morning down on, right near Capitol Hill, on a program on how we can use technology to address human trafficking, which is my next book that I'm working on, that I just got my contract for that. But I had to understand a lot about what was history like before the present day, and why we had such trouble, not just now, before the advent of technology, but in the past, in dealing and addressing slavery, which was the predecessor to human trafficking. And if we think of finding this much trafficking in cyberspace, think about the oceans before, and this great uncharted world that existed before. So let me read you a memoir of a British sea captain who was expected to stop the slave trade off the coast of West Africa. And he wrote of the difficulty of implementing anti-slavery policy. "Here we are on the most miserable station in the wide world, attempting an impossibility, the suppression of the slave trade. We look upon the whole affair out here as a complete humbug. So long as a slave worth only a few dollars here fetches 80 or 100 pounds in America, men and means will be found to evade the strictest blockade." So if we understand the challenges that we're having today and how they are driven by the profits of the tech community and the demand, this is a problem that has historical precedence. And I wanted us to understand it's not as if we're just looking at dark commerce today. It has existed before. And if we keep existing as a planet, it will keep existing in the future. Also, one of the things that I found in working on this topic that was extremely depressing was the growth of the illicit fentanyl trade in the United States that's killing communities, it's killing individuals and having an enormous consequence on our life in the United States. And since the book, I've been doing research on how this fentanyl trade is functioning in our country and how it is being marketed here, but that's another story. But in this account of this opium trade that I write about, of how it existed in China, I should go back a bit and say that most of the fentanyl that is entering the United States is coming from China, either being shipped to Mexico or entering by individuals purchasing it on the web. And I refer to this as the revenge of the opium wars, because in about 5-6 years ago, I was in China, and I was taken to a museum in China on the history of crime and the present state of crime. And one of the exhibitions I was taken and shown was the British use of the opium as a way of bringing down China. And China has a long history, and 150 or 160, 70 years is not long in terms of the length of Chinese history. When we think about this problem and who is involved in it, we tend to talk in this country about gangs and low-level actors, but there are many places in the world, as I talk about in this book, in which you have high social status individuals who are part of the trafficking problem. Corrupted individuals, even heads of state that are involved in trafficking. We can talk about the former president of Venezuela whose nephews were using the presidential airstrips to beat trafficking drugs. But this is not a matter of history and of the contemporary period. It's also a fact that in history, high status individuals were involved in the drug trade. It was not just states like the UK, but high status individuals. In the Second Opium War, 1856 to 1860, the Americans and the French joined with the British against the Chinese, forcing the legalization of the opium trade and the opening of trade ports in China. One key participant in the opium trade was President Franklin Roosevelt's grandfather, Warren Delano, a senior partner in Russell & Company, a Boston trading company who deemed that all was fair in the pursuit of profits. Consequently, Warren Delano's involvement in illicit trade was no impediment to his daughter's entree into good society as a debutante and her marriage into the prominent Roosevelt family. So we have problems of illicit trade and a great diversity of actors who've been involved in it. And that's one of the important points that I want to make in this book, that illicit trade is not just the simple act of smuggling some goods across the border. It has often served important political functions. In going back and reading French history, there was a certain textile that came from India that was very popular. And the importation of this textile and tobacco was a royal monopoly. And so the smuggler who sold things in violation of the royal monopoly was somebody who was very popular to the French, who were groaning under the high taxation of the authoritarian French monopoly. And so that gets us to music and culture. And we had songs back in 18th century or earlier in France glorifying the smugglers and the role that they were having in basically opposing authoritarian rule. And the number of smugglers was so great that we're talking about tens of thousands of people being killed for their role in smuggling. And there's research that suggests that this brutal action against illicit trade was one of the triggers of the French Revolution. So we need to think about illicit trade not just as a commercial issue, but as a political and social issue. And I tie that into some of the consequences that we have of the fentanyl trade today. One of the other issues that I found that was very important to understand was what I would call the attack on the environment. When we think about illicit trade, people thought that it'd be writing a book on drugs, human trafficking, but that's not what this book is about. But I couldn't leave them out of this book, but this book is about many, many other forms of illicit trade that are undermining the sustainability of the planet. For example, we have enormous amounts of illicit trade in forest products. One third of the supposedly wild-caught fish that's come into the United States is illegally obtained. It's IUU fishing. And who engages in this unauthorized fishing is corporations that are using trafficked laborers. So if they get caught, they can abandon the workers from their ships, and these people are often refugees like Rohingyas and others who have no legal status and can be abandoned along with the boat. It's like abandoning drug traffickers losing planes. That's a cost of doing business. This is a cost of selling illegally obtained fish. And it's a massive problem. Yesterday, I was talking to an activist from Guatemala who was saying that, yes, we think about the drug issue in Guatemala and how important it is, but the major corruption investigations of the leadership in Guatemala have been heavily connected with the deforestation of Guatemala. And so we have conflict, we've got migration issues, we have many other problems tied to deforestation, and it has devastating consequences. One of my favorite stories that I tell over and over from this book is one on the island of Sarawak. The province of Sarawak in Borneo. And it had a kleptocratic leader who deforested 80% of one of the world's great rainforests, gaining tens of billions of dollars from Mr. Tayyip. And he would have to, out of these billions, pay off some of the leadership of Malaysia. But he managed to launder an enormous amount of this money. And where did he launder it? This is what's so interesting. Our major agency in the United States to investigate corruption is the FBI. And he with his billions, bought the Lincoln Building in Seattle. And the Lincoln Building in Seattle is where the regional headquarters of the FBI is based. And so here you have the absolute irony of what is going on and how this money gets cleaned globally. Why I can talk about this is that these kleptocrats have enormous amounts of money and can sue you. But the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, did an investigation of this and said, listen, folks, we need to investigate who we are renting property from. This is a national security issue, and we should not be enriching foreigners, especially kleptocrats, with U.S. government money. And since there's a documented report on this, I always cite this, and nobody can sue me on it. So this is, this work has risks in that I know researchers who've had problems, but that's why in finding cases, one needs to be very careful in how you document them, how you explain them, and what you're using. Now, so why are we having such a growth in this environmental crime? Most, when we look at growth rates in the world, I mean, we're talking of maybe 3% growth if we're lucky, but this environmental crime has been growing consistently at 5 to 7% a year. And if you were a rhinoceros, the growth rate of killing rhinoceri is exponential growth, not 5 to 7% a year. So what is going on that makes this such a growth industry? Part of it is that we now have 7.5 billion people on the planet. Many of these people are living in countries in Asia with newly emergent middle classes, and so they want the quality of life, the fish, the timber for their homes that was not accessible before. And so there's an enormous amount of demand within Asia with new middle classes. Some of it comes like rhino horn for medicinal purposes or status purposes. And so we're having a world in which there is diminishing resources and increasing numbers of people. And this environmental crime is not just eliminating species. It is taking sand from the coasts of India. It is taking counterfeit pesticides are being produced in India. And the Indian, basically, Business Council has reported that about one-third of the pesticides in India are illegal. So if you want to understand why there's so many farmers killing themselves, part of it comes from this, in that there are not adequate controls over the quality of products that are being sold. So there are all kinds of implications of this activity. Another example, which I found first in Dirty Entanglements, is that the Italian organized crime, if you remember The Sopranos and your favorite TV shows of the past, are in the business of what? Garbage collection. So their cousins in Italy are also in garbage collection. But that garbage collection includes not just normal garbage, it includes hazardous waste, medical waste, and to save money, they don't dispose of it properly. What do? They transport it. Now, what countries in Africa did the Italians have long-term relationships with? Libya, where else? Huh?
Ethiopia,
Somalia, right? So you have long-term relationships, and what do with your long-term relationships? You have some people that you know, and so you take your garbage, your radioactive garbage from Italy, and you dump it off the coast of Somalia, right? This is where history matters. It explains continuing bad behavior. You behave badly as a colonial ruler, and you behave badly today. So what happens when you dump radioactive waste? What does it do to fish? Kills them, exactly. So what do all the fishermen do? They don't have an income source anymore. So what do they do? What is their new industry to take their boats? Pirates, exactly. So part of what I try to show in this illicit trade is that there's a logic to it, right? It's not as if it comes out of nowhere. There's not a historical context. And one set of activities, one place, triggers something that's very different in another part of the world. It's a very complex and interesting story, and you have to understand much to do this. And doing this is sort of the fun of being a storyteller, because even though this book is with Princeton, part of what Princeton tries to do is have books that have intellectual ideas, but that can reach larger audiences. So they were very happy for me to sort of think through these themes that I could explain and get this across to audiences. And this is exactly what the Carnegie Corporation was doing in trying to fund activity that takes academic research and brings and illuminates burning global issues. So, what is driving this environment is, one, is increasing scarcity, as I'm talking about, diversification away from risk. Businessmen think normally about, or businesswomen, about reducing risk. So if you have a great chance of being arrested for drug trafficking, you have much less chance of being arrested for engaging in illegal abalone fishing, for example. And we had a discussion a few weeks ago in a session that we had on trade-based money laundering, which sounds like a very boring topic, but involved a case in which a man was illegally exporting rockfish from South Africa to Maine. That's trade-based money laundering of an endangered species. And then he trafficked women from South Africa to Maine to process the lobsters below the minimum wage because they were illegal. So this is diverse, and this was not found for a very long time because it's low-risk activity. So this is part of what is driving this trade. And I think that's important also of understanding what is growing this trade in the cyber world. I think there are two major parts of this. One is, you know, the desire to innovate. But who is innovating in this cyber world of massive ads for human trafficking victims, online, you know, dark markets that are selling drugs? there, part of it comes out of what I would think, I'll explain as some of the computer geeks who were involved in this business. For example, I talk about the Silk Road that was run and operated by a dropout in physics from Penn State. And he was a libertarian, so he wanted to create a drug market that made drugs accessible to people. He began, however, to cross the line when people didn't pay their debts, and then he online hired hitmen to eliminate some of his debtors. And as the judge who sentenced him to multiple life sentences commented that whether they found these corpses or not was not really material to his sentencing. I mean, he actually tried to kill all these people, and there were numbers of hits he paid for in cryptocurrency. But there was a certain, how do I say, lack of reality of what he was dealing with, even though there were people who actually died from buying the drugs that were online. So part of it comes from a computer culture that is very removed from the people and the world in which they're operating. That's part of it, where we have the dark markets and others out of our culture that are creating this illicit world online. But I started out in this field, in my research, as an expert in the former Soviet Union. That's my origins as a researcher. And you'll say, well, how is that relevant? Well, if you look at some of the largest online networks that have been broken down, one of them is called Avalanche. And they were operating out of the former Soviet space. And you'll say, why is that? Well, let me tell you a little bit about the business community in the former Soviet Union. You've been hearing a little bit about it in our current investigations and how, in the United States Congress, of how corrupt this business community is. But there are other problems with this community beyond its corruption. And there's a problem known as corporate raiding, which is intimately tied to this corruption. But what happens is that you set up a business, you grow your business, and then somebody who's more politically connected than you basically takes over your business. They don't come in one day with rifles and take it over. But usually they do it through fraudulent documents, influence of the prosecutor, signing away your property rights. And this is a very familiar problem in Russia, in Ukraine, and some other places in the former Soviet Union where there is a lot of computer talent. Here, if you have great computer talent, you can go get a job at Amazon and Google and other large companies that are looking for you and will pay you a wage that you'll think it's the risk factor, it's better to work in the legal sector than start an online criminal business. But in that environment, there is so little entrepreneurship because the consequences of successful entrepreneurship are so great. Not only do you lose your business, but in Russia, between 100 and 200,000 businessmen are imprisoned every year as they take over their business because the law enforcement system collaborates with it. So there's an enormous incentive to start your own business and be your own illegal business because there's no legal business to join. And this is why so much of this illicit activity is coming out of the former socialist world. It's part of the culture, but it's also part of the economic environment and the political reality of what corruption does and how it undermines the society. So there are many, many consequences of this. And I'm not hopeless about this. After all, I set off to write a summing up of where we were, which is not, I don't like the trajectories that we're on. But sitting today in the meeting that I was on human trafficking is characteristic of what is going on as the world begins to mobilize, is that you find unusual coalitions of business and government and civil society, academics, working together to address this issue. And I say in conclusion, strategies to counter illicit trade must educate the world's population and draw on the insights of human psychology, economics, and the application of legal norms. Exceptional individuals risk their lives for this objective, such as the activists and investigative journalists who counter and document human trafficking, the drug trade, illegal timber harvesting, and illicit financial flows. New technology and data analytic tools are being developed by government and the private sector to counter the growth of illicit trade, particularly in the cyber world. But, as I say, why is there no collective or coordinated response? Is it time to alter how we view this subject and cast aside the term illicit? Do its negative implications and connotations lead to misunderstandings? The challenges are great, and the windows of opportunity to reverse the planet's present tragic course are limited. Let us hope that the mundane but important acts of ordinary citizens, combined with the extraordinary acts of the few, help reverse the current growth trajectory of dark commerce. We do not want a future where there is no trade of any form, nor jobs on a dead planet. And this is part of what I value about being a George Mason. For example, we now have 500 faculty connected with this Center on Sustainability. We have such an innovative, multidisciplinary culture at this university, and we allow innovation to flourish here. And I think that that's part of what's exciting, to be part of this community where you can really push the envelope and where you get rewarded, like the president saying, you try for this fellowship. And this is not conventional, and yet, you know, I managed to do this. I mean, I managed to get the fellowship, and I managed to write the book that I actually said I would do in the fellowship. I mean, the two really resemble each other. So this is the rewards of being here. And I think it's rewarding for many of our students as well. I see students, I see, you know, people who work here in this community, and that's what's really exciting about George Mason. And I'm leaving some time for questions because I know I've got a highly educated audience here. Thank you. Yes.
My name is Laura Rivera. I graduated from the National Public Policy last year.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. I did some research on both criminal groups that conduct illicit trade for profit motive,
mm-hmm.
and then terrorist groups that do so to try to fuel their sort of plans for terrorism. And some convergence between the two in terms of terrorists adopting criminal activity, usually attributed to criminal groups. Do you foresee in the future that world criminal groups will try to co-opt this kind of technology in terms of the dark commerce and going more towards a profit motive to try to fuel, fill their coffers with money as other traditional sources of revenue try to wither away?
All right. What you're asking about the future has been with us for a long time already. So this is part of where I was when I finished Dirty Entanglements and came to write this book. In, just to backtrack a little, in Dirty Entanglements, I went through, as the first chapter, the six most deadly attacks of the 2000s. Which was 9/11 others. And one of them was the attack in Bali, in Indonesia. And much of the money for that was done through online fundraising on the web by a terrorist group. So that's already about 15 years ago, where you have a lot of online activity appropriated and used effectively by terrorists. When I finished that book, Dirty Entanglements, and it came out, I was asked to talk at Europol to the, because one of my activities and that helped me write this book and the last one was my involvement with the World Economic Forum for 6 years, in which I worked with people from very different sectors, law enforcement, NGOs, and so forth. And the director said, but we're not seeing a relationship much between crime and terrorism. That was before the French attacks. And now Europol is forced to do constant reviews of its data files for criminals and terrorists, correlating the two of them. Because in France, for example, about 85% of the terrorists have backgrounds in crime, many of them recruited in prison. So it's not so much a problem of a convergence and interaction, but also a tactic of terrorists recruiting criminals who can provide all kinds of skill sets for them. One of the projects that we recently finished at TRAC was an analysis of how much the antiquities trade is going on to benefit terrorists and insurgents in Syria and Iraq, and how much of it is going on online in the deep and the dark web. And we're now doing a book on this. So that's one of our coming attractions. But we found that there was not much use of the dark web because you wanted to reach a large customer base. And so many objects were being sold on open web and disguised in various ways. But when we went back and traced through the Facebook posts of people who were selling this, we could see that they were associated with terrorists or were terrorist sympathizers. So this is well advanced. This is not the future. Yes. I have. It's not a great depth in this book, but I've focused on it, and we've had events at TRAC by one researcher that worked on organ trafficking, and then I don't know if you know Dr. Nauru Koizumi, who's one of my colleagues, but now she has an NSF grant, and she's off this semester, and she's going to Bangladesh and Nepal to be doing some of her research there. So yes, it's a problem. And it's just one of the elements of human trafficking that are growing. And in part, it's being facilitated through the dark web, not, I don't know about skeletons, but kidney trafficking through the dark web and closed networks that allow people to negotiate about things that are not going to be easily detected by law enforcement. Yes?
Just to follow up on that, do you think that there's a significant role for kind of grassroots and ground up kind of movements in bringing to light some of these networks and problems? I mean, if universities are not asked where they're getting their materials from, then they don't seem to care. And if people who are at the store don't care where their fish came from, then this kind of illegal trafficking and fishing and things like that are going to change.
There's room, and that's part of what I write about in this, for every level of involvement in this, from down below to financial institutions to others doing doing network analysis. I'll give you an example of a paper that I presented last week with a younger scholar, and it concerns the largest trafficking network that has ever been discovered. And this was done because DARPA, some of you know DARPA, which is the research arm of the Pentagon, spent about $60 million of developing tools to mine the deep and the dark web. And while they were doing this, they applied this to human trafficking because it's so heavily used by criminals that it was the perfect test case for this. And while they were doing this, some of the researchers mapped out a network they were finding through these advertisements. And this was handed over to the FBI, and then earlier this year, to their great surprise, came out an indictment of this network. But where was the network when the federal prosecutors announced the indictment? Part of the indictment was in Portland, Oregon. Why? Because there's a group called Crime Stoppers, and they were observing people going to a massage parlor at odd hours of the day, and they called law enforcement. So that, and that bottom-up approach combined with the most rapid, well, not rapid, advanced data analytics done by this tool out of DARPA helped bring this case to fruition. So it's not like either or. It's got to be a combination of the two of them. And it works. Yes.
Google gets out from engineering. I look at the effect of explosives on the structures, so I'm wondering if there is trafficking. You looked at into explosives or weapons trafficking.
Absolutely. I'm not been looking so much at explosives, but of weapons trade. And part of this is a problem that's also facilitated through social media. So there was one study that was done on Facebook in which it was found that 70 different types of weaponry out of Libya were being traded through Facebook. So we're having a session at TRAC next Wednesday. So please come. It's on November 13th, and it's on sanctions and WMD trade. And part of it is how do you find when there are sanction violations and how they're being detected by the financial community and how these networks work. So all these issues that I touch on in the book, I keep working on with others trying to probe more. Yeah?
Yes, my name is Joseph Huang. I'm doing a research fellow at the SCAR School as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so fascinated about, you mentioned earlier, some criminal activities in cyberspace. And daily, I'm doing research. I feel like because we do have a very, I wouldn't say perfect, but mature legal system in our territorial state system. So I was wondering whether or not we are able to territorialize cyberspace in order to borrow some legal system from the territorial world into this virtual cyber world. For example, like to build up some virtual borders or like a virtual territorial area in cyberspace in order to share responsibility in terms of criminal activities in cyberspace. So my question is, I feel like from a fundamental perspective, do you feel like this idea or arguments might be useful to deal with some criminal activities in cyberspace?
Yes, but only in a limited way. And I'll explain to you what I mean of what are the limits. You can establish cyber conventions, and the UN is pushing activity to help make the legal system work better in cyberspace. But one of the things that's been done in the past and will be done in the future. So for over 20 years, people who are specialists in cybercrime provide, sort of disguise the origin of where they're operating from, so that you can't even know what jurisdiction that you're coming from. So that's, so who do you have? For example, at one point, I remember in the late 1990s, visiting the customs office that was investigating child pornography. And there was massive downloads of a site that was had its sign as Tajikistan. It was not from Tajikistan. It was disguised as Tajikistan. It was operating out of Boston. But it took people a long time to figure out where it was operating from and then who would have jurisdiction over it. But we're also talking about a problem where you have corrupt senior officials and you have state involvement in this activity. And so if you have state involvement in it, how willing are they to actually police the websites that are coming and registered in their country? If this is a sort of another type of conflict where you're using war and illicit trade as an instrument of the state. And so that's also a problem. So law is not the solution to all of this. Without it, you have problems, but it's not, you know, the total resolution of this problem. And the ingenuity of these people to, in this case that I was looking at with this, that involved both DARPA tools and informants from Crime Stoppers, you had one webmaster who managed to create literally hundreds of thousands of web ads. One person with just enormous capacity to do this. So, you know, but if he's overseas and the investigation is in the US, how do you reach this person? People don't want to extradite their criminals to be handled in other countries. Yes.
Thanks for a wonderful talk, Louise. So you raise a really important point that a lot of these problems, say human trafficking, are not things you can prosecute your way out of, right? We spend a lot of our time on the process and figuring out how we can detect and disrupt these networks and prosecute people, but you wisely pointed out the underlying drivers of this are supply and demand. How optimistic are you, knowing what you know, that as a species we can tackle those actually much more complex problems of supply and demand?
I mean, first we have to acknowledge this problem, and we're not doing enough of that. And that's sort of what I was hoping in this book. The book so far has sold a few thousand copies. Where I reach this audience is doing, programs on radio. And, the book provides an excuse to reach out and reach different audiences. And people are not aware. They're not aware of the complexity of this phenomenon, the speed at which it's occurring, and people identify and think about certain charismatic species, like elephants or rhino, which I adore these animals. They are magnificent, they're charismatic, but a lot of the damage that is being done to the planet is things that are much less visible, that have not as much traction and concern. And the fact that we've got so much massive overfishing combined with now global, warming in our oceans, which is also threatening the remaining stock, we're really on a very serious trajectory. And it's not just a question of conservation science, but how conservation science has to work with these problems and this reality and the violence that people are using against those who are protecting the environment, like guards, and the amount of violence that is accompanying these profits, and how much this situation is also driving migration and illegal migration. Are there any other questions? Okay, we're just at 4:30, so I can stop, and we have a few drinks, and you've been a great audience, so thank you. Oh, well, I hope this works.
Okay.
And let's see.
Please feel free to...